This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
And welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
Welcome back, everyone.
We're here again.
We're here again, and we're here somewhere different. Jason, where are we right now?
Well, Sam, we're in our brand new studio!
Which is also my spare room that we finally, after 2 months of my roommate leaving, have got cleaned and organized. So,
yeah.
I don't know if it's going to sound any different. When we were doing our pre-roll talking to the patrons, I said, and I still do say, that I think it sounds a little different, but who knows? At any point, hopefully it doesn't sound worse. That's really all I want. It almost feels professional in a way, but in another way,
you keep
not
those
at
words
all.
Away from us.
Yeah, not at all. And the other biggest difference I would say is that Jason and I are now 6 feet away from each other, whereas normally we're only 3 feet away from each other. And you know, in movies when like, it has like an unhappy marriage and like there's a very, very long table between them.
Yeah, this is our void.
Yeah, I feel like that's where we are right now.
Nah.
We're picking up where we left off last week. If you'll remember, last week was our disappointingly not historical at all beginning to our series on aliens in the Cold War.
Yeah, space people.
So last week we talked about the arms race, probably the biggest, I would say, leftover portion of the Cold War, something we're still interacting with and dealing with today. This week we're going to talk about something that, while we still have, and it still happens, it definitely not as much to the magnitude as it was during the Cold War, but something that probably wouldn't exist the way it does now without it. And I'm talking, of course, about NASA and the space race in general.
Okay.
The space race, to me, it's one of the three biggest things, and especially in regards to aliens and all of that, biggest things to come out of the Cold War. And as we're going to see, just like last week, we had UFOs flying over nuclear weapons, activating and deactivating them, making their mark on the arms race. They made their mark on the space race as well. So we're going to spend some time looking specifically at some sightings that have been made by both astronauts and cosmonauts of strange things beyond the boundaries of planet Earth. Now, last week, Jason, you used a specific phrase in regards to the UFOs interacting with the nuclear weapons. Do you remember what that phrase was?
Oh, yes, and I already regret it. Guardian angels.
Guardian angel. And I said to you, you have no idea. Now, our first event
tonight...
And you're
right, I didn't.
You did not. Our first event tonight comes to us from beyond the Iron Curtain, and it has to do exactly with this idea of guardian angels. Now, this idea, you know, it typically comes to us from childhood, that there's someone or something paying close attention to us, making sure that we survive life enough to get to the chance to where we flourish into adulthood. The same may be true of the entire human race, especially when taking this story at face value. Now, it comes to us, like I said, from the other side of the Iron Curtain, which I'm sure extends all the way up beyond the atmosphere into outer space, always rotating and moving with the Earth, just breaking satellites as it goes. And what we're looking at is this...
That was an interesting that you did there at that one.
Thank you. Thank you. What we're looking at is the Soviet space station, which is the Salyut 7, which translates to Salute 7. So I'm probably just going to say salute.
Is that referring to like seven different people, or is it just like the
no,
salute number seven?
Yeah, I
like
think
the
it's
mambo number five.
Exactly. No,
okay.
Na-na-na-na. Wait, which one's the mambo? No, that's na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, right?
Sure.
Okay. cool. Good.
I'm not great with music.
That's fair.
Not like beats and stuff like that.
That's all right. Now, the station itself was launched in May of 1982 and was only in use for about 4 years when the final crew left for home in 1986. Then it started its decline, which ended in its re-entry 5 years later in 1991. Our story comes from dead in the middle of the time that it was being occupied by cosmonauts, which I feel like everybody probably knows this already, but just so you know, an astronaut is an American or like allied person in space, and a cosmonaut is a Soviet person in space. So that's
which
why.
One do you think sounds cooler?
Cosmonaut, yeah, to be too. Sure. Oh, it's, yeah.
It's embarrassing.
It's like, why couldn't we have thought of that?
I know, right?
You're literally
in the cosmos.
Yeah, navigating the cosmos as opposed to navigating astrologically, astronomically. Who knows? It's unclear.
I'm sure someone that's listening knows.
This is one of the things about Stalin.
Hey, there it is. We found it.
Yeah.
Great at
naming things. In any case, now the men who were up there, there were three of them. There were two cosmonauts, one by the name of Leonid Kim, one by the name of Vladimir Solovyov, and one cardiologist by the name of Oleg Atkov. Now, they had been up there in space for 155 days at this point. Now, to be fair, you think about people being up in space for a very long time, very small place, confined. Things are going strange. They're seeing things. Things are happening. And the first thing that I think probably most people are going to come up with is some variation of the idea of like space madness, which is one of the most well-known and played out tropes of fiction, where because you're isolated from the world as you know it and sailing through the skies into the unknown, you lose your mind, just like it might happen if you were out on sea for many
days.
Yeah,
and I mean, that makes sense. We're used to being on ground on Earth, and being away is a completely different physical state of being, almost.
Exactly. And all of the space station or space agencies of the world were very concerned with this, especially at first. They're still a little concerned with it today, but almost.
I'm surprised you wouldn't just get a panic attack.
Well, I'm sure that,
like, there's the Earth. Oh, boy.
Oh, God. What have I done? Get me home. You don't have that option to go home. Space is the only place where you don't really have the option to go home before it's time to go home. It's not like having a sleepover.
If you do go home before it happens, it's usually not because you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and we'll talk about that because, like, there is a very specific thing that seems to happen to people when they see the Earth from space. Panic, sometimes. But this idea of space madness, it's not something that really happens. There haven't been any documented accounts of it, either within or without the Allied borders. And so I just want to preface what I'm about to say with that. Because what I'm about to say may sound a little crazy.
What?
Yes. Now, this event, it begins as it was described by the men there, who, of course, each corroborated every other story. It started with a bright orange cloud, which seemed to envelop the space station. Now, the crew, who had been subjected to a number of system failures and things going very, very wrong in the last 4 months of their stay, they began by assuming the worst. Because there was orange hues and lights, they assumed that there was some sort of a fire inside the capsule that was sure to pretty much barbecue them alive in space. So there's that. That's a pretty terrible thing to happen. So they leap into action, but they don't find any indications of any system failures. They don't see any alarms going off, and they aren't able to feel any additional heat or really anything that would suggest a fire or any other malfunction other than the light itself. So then they stop and they say, well, okay, so where is this light actually coming from? And what they find is that as opposed to being potentially something inside the station somewhere going out, the light is streaming in through the portholes, is what they referred to the windows as, streaming in through the portholes. And so they run, kind of. You can't really run in space.
They float quickly.
They float with urgency. over to the portholes. And at first it's so bright that they cannot see anything. But slowly their eyes adjust. And when they do adjust, each of the men is met with the strangest sight he had ever seen. They were angels. Literally real, full-blown angels. And to be precise, there were 7 of them. Now, the beings were described as genuinely winged, just like most people would imagine them. However, of course, in the Bible, angels aren't like beautiful people with wings. They're like an amalgamation of a million eyes and wings and fire. And it's very scary stuff. But this isn't what those people saw. They saw very beautiful, pale people with wings, golden hair, white robes, and a serene, calm, peaceful look on their face.
So a modern interpretation of what an angel
exactly
should be.
They even had halos, but the halos seemed not as, I mean, when you look at especially like Renaissance art, you look like you could pluck one of those and hit a person with it.
In All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Sure, exactly. Yes, I didn't even think about that. But here, their halos were more of a mist and a cloud or a fog behind their head. The other thing is that they were 80 feet tall, or 24.4 meters, with wingspans that were described as the length of a 747, which is 232 feet, or 71 meters. Now, like I said, there were 7 of them, and they seemed to be circling the station, all equidistant from each other, equidistant from the station. And the men claimed...
That's not terrifying.
Right? The men claimed that the beings seemed to be directing their attention towards the station. And as they did, this wave of calm overcame them. If I saw 7 giants of truly epic proportion around my spacecraft, first off, I'm anxious because I'm in space and no one can hear you scream. That's literally the thing of it. No one can hear you scream. I'd already be scared about that. And so now there are literal giants floating in the air without spacesuits just looking at me. And yet each of the men reported peace and serenity and even joy.
I find it incredibly weird that the angels were just wearing robes.
What? The angel needs to wear a spacesuit and a helmet?
I mean, like, you would think it'd be that or just like nothing at all.
Oh, I see where you're coming from.
You mean
from.
Like you would either need some sort of protection or if you can survive the harshness of space, why are you wearing a robe?
I think wearing a robe to wear a robe. They're modest beings. I can technically survive outside without wearing anything, but that doesn't mean I'd want to.
Yeah, not very long. It'd be very uncomfortable.
I could walk, even with how cold it is, I could probably be outside for like an hour before I just got chilled to the bone.
Yeah.
And in summertime, doubly so.
Well, summertime, you're going to be fine.
Exactly.
All right, fair, whatever.
I just think that's a weird, like of all of the things to latch onto, the fact that they're wearing clothes is not what I would assume. I don't know.
Is it like
man.
A really furry bathrobe or something? Or like something really fluffy? I mean, not furry. I mean, just soft and nice.
They did not describe in detail
the
consistency of the robe or the fashion.
Think about
of
the
it.
Textile work that it would take to fashion those.
Be truly astounding, wouldn't it?
That would be on one of those modern Marvel TV shows from History Channel.
The angels' clothes. Okay, so, yes.
Latching on real hard. Not letting go.
Now, the angels remained where they were for about 10 minutes. And at that point, they just disappeared. They just blinked out. And as they did, the light that accompanied them disappeared as well. Now, I like to imagine that the next 11 days for the cosmonauts were quite awkward. There's probably a lot of sitting, staring at each other, looking in the mirror, a lot of quiet, and a lot of thinking.
So how are we sure it wasn't just like a weird thing with radiation or light and stuff like that, like aurora borealis, like the auroras? Like, how are we sure it's just not some really interesting formation from something of that similar nature?
That is a good question.
Well, I mean, that's based because of the atmosphere and stuff, but... Still, like, radiation and light works differently
sure,
in outer space than that than it does in our atmosphere.
Sometimes it casts the image of angels.
Hey, man. Shapes, bro.
It's true. Well, and you do. You have this idea that while there's definitely there can be mass panic and there can be shared states of psychoactive unsettledness, and there can be suggestibility between the three of them, your ideas of like a mass hallucination, or maybe even the idea of like some natural phenomena. If it is a natural phenomena, I'm almost as interested to figure out what that is as if it were actually angels. Whatever could like make such a thing happen that way. We don't know for sure. The biggest difference, I would say, is that with a natural phenomena like the aurora borealis or anything with light and radiation, you may see it, you may feel awe at it, but it won't be able to project a uniform feeling throughout all of its observers. Whereas all three of these people, imagine if you were the first person to see the aurora borealis, you probably would be like, wow, that's cool, but also, what the hell is going on? Am I about to die? What is happening here? And yet not a single one of them had anything other than a very calm, peaceful sensation. So the next thing that people point to, not that we're done with this story because we're not, but the next thing that people point to a lot of times is this idea of a CO2 leak, which we'll actually talk about later on as well.
Oh man, they hallucinate?
Well, there could be a hallucination.
Oh boy.
You could get a little high, and maybe being a little high on CO2 deadens your anxiety and your fear. Jason, what are you doing?
Nothing.
That's like that.
Don't you worry about
that's
it.
Like he was making a face akin to the meme of Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception when he's like Mr. Cobb and then he's got his eyes all squinty, and it was fantastic. But in that case, and again, all we have is the word of at this point, three cosmonauts, but again, no sensors were going off. Nothing seemed to indicate that it would be something natural affecting their mental states, because there were no sensors of anything going off of escaping. And also because the thing, it stopped, they disappeared. Now, if they disappeared and there was a CO2 leak and there was nothing to warn them there was a CO2 leak, they'd be dead pretty soon. Like,
yeah,
they wouldn't have survived. So I don't know. You know, it very well could be a natural occurrence somewhere.
Okay.
Okay. And I like to think that these are probably the things that they were talking about when they were up there, saying, you know, could it have been this? Could it have been that? And trying to come to any conclusion other than, we saw literal angels. And yet, 11 days later, something happens that kind of makes it harder for them to say that. Because, see, sometime around the 17th, an additional detail of cosmonauts arrived at the station, carrying three additional crew members. Here we go. There was Vladimir Dezabon...
Dude, you were...
I was going into it like I knew how to say it.
Yeah, I was like, oh man, he's got...
Oh. He's gonna do. Oh no, he's not.
See, I would have stopped right at the Z.
That's fair. Let me do this here.
For everyone, it's spelled DZH.
DZHANIBEKOV. Dizhanibekov. Vladimir Dizhanibekov. There we go. Well, perfect.
Sure.
There was also Igor Volk and Svetlana Savitskaya. Now, and Svetlana is a fairly famous individual. She was the second woman in space and the first woman to engage in an extravehicular activity in space, which in this case would be going on a spacewalk, which is probably the worst thing that I could imagine in my life. Like, people are like, oh, wouldn't you want to experience that, being out in space with nothing but a tether to hold you to civilization as we know it? And it's like, no, actually, I'd rather be dead. Thank you. Because if I'm dead, I'm dead. If I'm doing that, I'm about to be dead. And I don't want that anticipation.
Oh, man. Okay.
Now, mainly the reason why I went on that little tangent about spacewalks is because I was writing that, I was sitting in my Apple TV The screensaver had gone to the outer space screensaver.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very beautiful to behold, but also very scary. It scared me quite a bit. I got spooked. So.
By a picture on your TV.
By a picture on my TV. Of space.
This is the kind of person Sam is.
Yep. Now, this spacewalk, the one that Svetlana is very famous for, it took place on July 25th. And it should be the most important thing that happened during this trip. And really, scientifically speaking, it was. But on the 23rd, just days after the auxiliary crew had arrived, a few days before the spacewalk, and exactly 11 days since the previous sighting, the orange glow once again encompassed the space station. And this time, all six of the station members reported seeing these same sights, and they reported the sights back to ground control. An official statement from the people in the station that was used in the papers at the time was, quote, "They were glowing and we were truly overwhelmed. There was a great orange light, and through it we could see the figures of seven angels. They were smiling as though they shared a glorious secret, but within a few minutes they were gone, and we never saw them again." Now, within days, this auxiliary crew had returned to Earth. As the core group stayed up there, right? They stayed up there for another 2 months. They were doing stuff. The auxiliary crew, when they came home, all three of them were immediately debriefed. One of them, I can't remember which one, during his, like, quote-unquote debriefing, but it was really more of an interrogation, he was like, he was talking about the angels. And the person interrogating him was like, well, what did you see? It obviously couldn't have been that. That's ridiculous. And he said specifically, well, what if it was? What if I did see angels? And just like that, he was kicked out of Space Force. I don't know what it was called in the Soviet times and places, but stripped of his ability to go back to space. Everybody else, when they came home, the other two of the auxiliary crew and then the main crew, which came back months later, and they came back staggered as well. I don't think they each came back together. They all were led gently and kindly into talking it off and saying, you know what? Who knows what it could have been? It would have been useless for the media to try to, or for the government to try to say that nothing had happened because this got back to ground control and because there were reporters and that the reporters already got it out and stuff like that. But they were able to come away and say, well, you know, maybe nothing happened. Who knows? Every single one of these people did end up going through multiple batteries of physical and psychological examinations to determine what, if anything, could be the cause of the vision. There wasn't a single thing found in that regard medically. And this is a very strange story. This is a story that, to my knowledge itself, has never been repeated quite that way before, or it never happened before and never been repeated since, to have six highly trained people all see something that is clearly impossible like that at the same time. And not impossible like a saucer or a light or this or that, impossible like an 80-foot angel, seven of them to be precise. It's really a unique event. It's something that I want to talk about the meaning of and all of that a little later on. But Jason, what do you think of this?
I think it's really weird how they're described as angels because the Soviet Union isn't necessarily synonymous with religion.
Right.
So I thought it was really weird how they picked that terminology out of anything else I guess they could have used at that point in time. But I mean, like, where's the pictures?
There's no pictures.
Where's the proof?
There's no proof.
Where's the anything besides for witness testimony? Nada.
Nothing. Nothing other than the fact that you probably don't want to be lying in the Soviet Union. Like, I don't know. To me, it's like, and we know that the Soviets were so concerned, and the Americans as well, but so concerned with their image of being technologically superior and this, that, and the other thing. And
I think it was just superiority in general.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, arms race, space race, and the Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, if the Olympics doesn't show how much of a Cold War we had with Russia, I don't know what does.
But this idea that they are superior to us in every way, for six people who have been indoctrinated in that and trained in that to then come out of that and even if it's just in the moment, say that, it just betrays that something happened. I'm definitely not going to say that it was literal physical angels up in the sky. Could have been. Maybe. But who knows? I don't know. It's just like, I can totally see where in a more free and open place like America, if you say something crazy, like I saw a UFO or I saw an angel, yeah, you might be, you know, dismissed. You might be stripped of your rank. But there's a good chance that people not towing that party line are going to get killed. Like,
right. They're going to be silenced.
It just raises the stakes for me in a way that to me adds a lot of credibility to the story, even as fantastical as it seems. But anyway, that's just me.
That's fair.
That's fair.
I mean, that is a good point. But it was, what, 91?
82.
82 still? Like,
yeah, so
you don't
like,
have a camera up there, man?
Not Alone is sponsored by Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. Now, Robinhood has a commitment to making financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy, and that's why when you're using their application, you're going to find a simple and intuitive, clear design. With data that is presented in an easy-to-digest way, the end result is a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence. And while other brokerages may charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood does not charge commission fees. You can trade your stocks and keep all of your profits. When, like I said, it's easy to understand. There are charts, there's market data, and the app is so simplified that you can place a trade in just 4 taps of your smartphone. And if you're not sure what you'd like to invest in, the Robinhood web platform also lets you view stock collections, things like the 100 most popular stocks, or break it down by sectors, things like entertainment and social media, and even curated categories like female CEOs. And in addition to that, they provide analyst ratings of whether to buy, hold, or sell for every stock. You can learn by doing. You can learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. You can discover new stocks and track your favorite companies with personalized news feeds. And you can receive custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Now, Robinhood is giving all of our listeners a free stock. Now, these aren't some 2-bit penny stocks. This is stuff like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to either help start your portfolio or to continue to build it. Now, you can sign up at alone.robinhood.com. That's alone, A-L-O-N-E, .robinhood.com. Head on over, get your free stock, and start making your money work for you today. So that's one side of the story. One side of the story from one side of the combatants in the Cold War. So now we're going to hop over that infinitely long iron curtain, infinitely tall iron curtain. Maybe we'll have to go around it. And we're going to make our way back to the good old US of A, home of the free, land of the free. Hoo-ah. That's our motto. Isn't it?
No.
Okay. Now, probably the best case we have here is that of Gordon Cooper. Now, this is one that we actually talked about before. I believe it was during our Black Knight satellite episode. Gordon Cooper was one of the 7 original astronauts involved with the United States' first manned space program, Project Mercury. He piloted the final flight, which was Faith 7, making 22 orbits around the Earth in 34 hours, becoming the first American to go to sleep in space. An interesting distinction, but I really wonder, I just really love to know more about, like, if it was different, I guess, sleeping in space, what that was like. I don't know. But he was also the last American to conduct a solo mission into space. Now, As he was accomplishing all of these, he claimed to have seen some sort of a glowing green object whilst he was above the tracking station in Muchia, Australia. The object also appeared in the Australian tracking systems, and as quickly as it came, it went, and seemed to exhibit some sort of behavior which led Cooper to believe that it was extraterrestrial. Now, something that's interesting about this encounter is that most people, because of the logs from NASA and the records about this, they have no problem admitting that this did actually happen, but they also come back with a ready-made explanation for it. Like we had mentioned earlier, there's always a chance of a CO2 leak occurring, and in this case, it most definitely did occur. However,
we've solved it.
We've done it. However, while it may seem very likely that this green object piloted through space is just some sort of a hallucination, I won't disagree that that's a possibility, but I think when we look at the facts, it doesn't hold as much water. And the main reason why is because basically when Gordon Cooper was sent up there, I'm physically pointing up to space right now.
The ceiling,
Cooper. He was famously referred to as spam in a can because he was there, but everything was being done automatically. He had no control over it. It was all computers measuring this, measuring that, choosing this and that.
So he was just along for the ride.
He was just along for the ride and to make observations and this and that. However, when the CO2 leak occurred, it happened because his system started shutting down. Because all of his systems were linked, all of his systems shut down. And he was hurtling through space with absolutely no guidance. So what he does is using his wristwatch and a magic marker, the position of the stars, and a window of his capsule, he plots his own course and fires the retro rockets at exactly the right moment to take him right to where he needed to be out of the entire face of the Earth.
That's impressive.
Is amazing.
That's incredible.
And to me, it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that could be done by someone who is seeing things that aren't there, especially simply because if he's doing this all based on the stars and relative positions.
And that's insane because his perspective should be completely different than the perspective we have from the surface.
Yeah, it's insane. It's probably, I read that earlier today and I gasped. And I was like, this is probably the most impressive thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
This is why he got to space. Yeah. And I never will.
He's the spaceman, not me. But even if that hadn't happened, it is important to remember that there was still that object tracked moving strangely on radar on the ground as well. So when Cooper came home, however, he became almost overnight a very vocal and ardent supporter of UFO disclosure. And he's made a few very good quotes on the subject over the years. My favorite of which is, quote, "For many years, I have lived with a secret. In a secrecy imposed on all specialists in astronautics. I can now reveal that every day in the USA, our radar instruments capture objects of unknown form and composition to us. And there are thousands of witness reports and a quantity of documents to prove this, but nobody wants to make them public. Why? Because authority is afraid that people may think of God knows what kind of horrible invaders, so the password still is, we have to avoid panic by all means." And it is.
I have a problem with that, though.
Okay,
I have a really big problem with that statement. And it comes, again, to one of the points that I made in a much earlier episode, where there is no way that every government that has access to space, like, uniformly, like, agrees to keeping this a complete secret. Like, that and, like, how have we not had, like, a Snowden level of breach?
Some people would say that we have, Jason.
But, okay, yeah. But who's been marked a traitor for leaking UFO evidence?
We'll talk about them.
That Okay. Good.
I know there are people.
Because I want to know their names.
We need Rob.
And if they're hanging out in Russia now.
I almost want to just call Rob right now and be like, Rob, give me the name of the UFO people. Come on. There are. Well, and that's
like,
the thing.
Truly substantial evidence, though. Like, I mean, I want.
Sure.
Evidence.
I know you do. But that's the thing is like. And maybe I'm going to retract my original statement. There are people who will say that's been done. I don't know if they're right 100%. I don't know the story. I don't really know the story of a lot of whistleblowers and this and that when it comes to extraterrestrials. But what I do know is that when, like, even if we look back at last week's episode alone, the gentleman who was doing the videography, who captured the video of the craft interfering with a nuclear missile, when he came out and said, like, this happened, this is real, they did. They responded by saying, well, he wasn't even in the Air Force at the time. And he said, well, no, I was, and I can prove it. And, like...
Right, right. But what I'm getting at is that Snowden leaked so much information.
Sure.
That he was barred a traitor and had to flee the country.
Sure. I think, though, that if you...
Versus just kind of making up some fake paperwork to brush it under the rug.
Sure. But, like, if you were to actively pursue someone, and I guess my thing is if you give it that level of gravitas, then there's no way of saying that it wasn't true.
Right, right. And what I'm saying is that if you have a leak that large, there isn't a way of saying it's not true.
Possibly. We'll talk more about whistleblowers one day.
Okay.
I promise. I see where you're coming from. I do know that the majority
because
there, of...
Because there's just a lot of people in the cogs of the machine.
Totally. I agree.
And I'm sure more than just one or two people are like, the public should know about this.
Now, according to Cooper, this idea of avoiding panic by all means, this is the key to the alien cover-up, because he did believe it to be a cover-up. He said that it started... it started in World War II when we thought it was the Germans. Then it moved forward to the Cold War where we thought it was the Soviets. Then we realized it couldn't be the Soviets because of the maneuvers and this and that that were going on. So then we thought that if we disclosed this, the Soviets would have some sort of a lead on this superior technology that we ourselves were also trying to make good and make use of during the time. So it didn't start... maliciously. It started with national security and keeping things normal. I really think at this point, yes, people would be unsettled, but I really think that we could deal with it and it would probably help us as a civilization if we can say, like, definitively, yes, there are aliens. I think that that would do things for us that would push us in the right direction as
opposed
to the wrong
one.
Well,
not necessarily just aliens. I'm pretty sure most Americans assume that there is some sort of alien life out there, but intelligent alien life.
Right, right. That's the biggest thing. And intelligent alien life that is here.
Yeah.
Right? It's statistically, there's got to be aliens. They got to be. And statistically...
Yeah, right. Even if it's by bacteria.
Yeah. Well, and even then...
Whatever be close to bacteria
of 100,
in that evolution.
Of 100 billion galaxies, of 100 billion stars in each galaxy, like... And with our planet being, what, 4 billion years, 6 billion years old, in a universe that's pushing 15 billion, not pushing, but, you know, relatively speaking, like, statistically speaking, there is a...
They should have already been here.
But there is a very super advanced species out there somewhere. Probably never going to...
Potentially.
Yeah. But it's the idea that they're here. That's the biggest thing that most people are unwilling to concede. Which I am all too willing to concede.
Oh, don't we know it?
Now,
buddy O'Pal.
Now, Gordon Cooper saw a UFO. Thinks he saw a UFO. And is pretty...
Wait. Did he see a UFO? Or did he see, like, an extraterrestrial?
He saw a UFO.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he did not see extraterrestrials as far as we know.
But what I mean by that is, did he see something alien?
No.
Or... Was it strictly an unidentified flying object?
He believed it to be a UFO that was beyond the
alien
realm
origin.
Of normal physical possibility.
Thank you.
So, but he did not see a pilot in the UFO. He did not see whatever species was controlling this craft. So, The next guy we're going to talk about, the last guy we're going to talk about, my favorite guy, he did not see a UFO. He did not see an ET, but he knows that they're out there. So, this person is Edgar Mitchell. Edgar Mitchell was the pilot of the Apollo 14 mission, and he was the sixth man to walk on the moon. If my sources are correct.
Is it that big of a deal by then?
Sure.
Don't get me wrong. It would be incredible. But when do we stop that? And this is the 57th man on the moon.
I think that you probably keep it going for quite a while. Anyway, so here we have a man who is qualified to fly from here to the moon. And there's not many of those people out there. That's our first step. Step two to Edgar Mitchell is in an aim to introduce some cognitive dissonance into everyone, is that on the return flight from the moon, Edgar Mitchell participated in an unauthorized experiment testing extrasensory perception, or ESP, or psychic abilities, with a group of psychics waiting for his mental telepathic communications back home on Earth.
Well,
it was nice to know you, Ed.
I'm glad he just signs it the sixth man on the moon now.
Right. Right?
Not that ESP guy.
This experiment consisted mainly of him methodically randomizing cards with symbols on them, focusing on them, and then his co-researchers on Earth down there making, like, guesses as to which one he was thinking of and in what order and this and that. Now, according to him, it was a roaring success because the correct result was recorded 25% of the time, which he insisted is significantly higher than statistical chance, which with five cards.
How well did the people know him?
I don't know. It doesn't matter because his methods are very flawed anyway.
Oh, okay, perfect. So, like, I was going to say, like, if I was to choose a number, I'm sure someone that I'm close to would know, like, what number I'd probably choose out of five.
Really?
Yes. Probably.
That's bizarre.
You know?
I don't think
so. Does that not make sense?
No.
If I chose, like, a shape or something, you could probably tell which one I'd choose.
Well, but the point of it was that this was randomized. Like, he had the cards on a grid.
Yeah.
And then, like, he'd do some sort of a thing that would use the grid, that then he would choose that card, and then he'd hold that card and think about it. So he wasn't just choosing the cards based on, like, what he liked or wanted or subconsciously.
Yeah, but it sounds like the people on Earth had five options.
Yeah.
A multiple choice quiz here.
Yeah.
The answer is always C.
Anyway, so...
What I'm getting at is that there is still a controlled group.
Right.
And I don't think it's completely unbiased if you're talking to a very specific person about this and they are choosing things.
Sure. It doesn't matter because it's not real.
Like, okay, perfect.
He
Wait.
Okay.
You're saying it's not real.
He did do what he said he did. They did guess it right 25% of the time. Now, technically speaking, chance, 1 out of 5, would be 20% of the time if they were just guessing.
I can do basic math.
What he doesn't mention are a few really important things.
Oh, dear.
The first is that two of the people guessed higher than chance, and two of the people guessed lower than chance, which evens out to chance. The other thing that he fails to mention is that 20% of the time being correct, that's not one person. That's recorded amongst four different people. So four different people getting one thing right every time, that's about 25%. That's about chance. The other thing, and really all of that you can walk around and worm your way around is
so
fine.
Why did you mention it?
Just to let you know what kind of guy Edgar Mitchell was. He thought people could read his brain from space. That's what I'm getting at.
Okay,
here.
Okay.
But the other thing...
So you're setting up for something more.
Yeah. Oh, okay. A lot more. So the last thing is that with Mitchell and that study, he was supposed to do it at the same time every night. But then he didn't. And so they were sitting on ground doing their, like, let's think about this exercise. And he either had not done it yet or had done it hours ago. And, like, there was no link. So then he came out and said, well, it's not so much it's not psychic real time. It's precognition. So instead of proving a psychic link between us, me and the people on the ground, I prove that the people on the ground have precognitive abilities because they were making their guesses when I was not making my psychic manifestations. And so the only way they could have done that is if they could know the future in some small little way. So it's bunk all the way down. Like it's not
just bad science.
It's just bad juju bees. Bad juju bees all the way around.
Great.
So that's your setting here.
Perfect. We sent a man into space that thought that was an appropriate scientific
and that's
experiment.
The thing is that we that's sent him into space. We sent him into space.
It's because we wanted to get rid of him.
He piloted a spacecraft. He came down. He went back up. He did multiple space things for the United States.
Maybe he was just that good.
Well, it is. It is. He was that good. And that's what really astounds me.
He's like the crazy pilot.
He'll do what it takes.
He's a character, you know?
That's what astounds
but he's
me
just that good.
About Edgar Mitchell is that, like, on one hand, he's a guy who can fly a rocket to the moon and be fine and like, has that scientific knowledge and that, like, mental capacity. And on the other hand, he does something like this, where when he returns home, he founds something called the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is an attempt to study the connectivity between all living things, which is a byproduct, I kind of mentioned it earlier, of this experience that people have when they see planet Earth from space. Almost all astronauts talk about how it is a paradigm shift for them. And it makes them realize, it sounds cliche, but it makes them realize how small all of it is.
I don't think that makes it sound cliche whatsoever. Like, I was just at a very beautiful part of the country. Mm-hmm. And during my hikes and in my travels there, like, I would look at it and be awestruck, and I would keep walking and still be awestruck at the next site because it was just that impactful every turn. Magnify that to a level that I can't really even imagine, and you've got mm-hmm. what it probably feels like to look back at Earth from space.
Yeah.
I mean, that has to be profound.
Right. And that's the thing is, it's a cliche just because, like, it's what you would, I don't know. When I say that, it's because it's what you would expect. Yeah, of course, Earth looks small, and we're all small. But it is. It's that this is a deep psychological and spiritual thing that happens to people in space. And it's like, the only reason why I would want to go to space is to have that experience. All of the rest of it scares me beyond words. But it did. It changed him in a way. Now, that's not to say that he wasn't on it, you know, on whatever it is.
Oh.
Before he went up.
Interesting.
No, he wasn't on drugs. Okay. I just mean on that search for truth.
Bandwagon.
Because okay. He grew up like a few miles from Roswell and like really believed that that was a cover up and this and that. Again, he organized this entire psychic thing before he left for the Earth. So it was not this.
He didn't organize it very well then.
I know. It was not this experience that caused him to be this way, but it did amplify it. It
okay.
did say he, unlike a lot of people, they come home thinking, how can I make a physical difference on the world? Whereas Edgar Mitchell came back thinking that the way to make a difference on the world, and this is philosophically sound, the way to change the world is to change the self. And he spent a lot of time in meditation and exploring his consciousness and pushing things to the boundary of inner space as he had pushed to the boundary of outer space. He was the man who's been the longest on the moon. Nine and a half hours. He holds a record in that regard. And so when he comes home, he says, I'm going to look within me instead. And he does. He founds this Institute of Noetic Sciences, which sounds kind of fine. It's exploring consciousness and like the way that we're all interconnected to each other. But the same organization after he died, now it's being run by a person who just wrote a book about how it was the most infuriating thing I've ever read. This book is called Real Magic by a guy named Dean Radin. And
oh boy.
It's supposedly set. So the prologue, it's not set. It's a self-help book in its own way. It's like making yourself better
okay.
through magic. So, but the preface to it is a newspaper article from the 30th century regarding an archaeological find from the 24th century, which was a newspaper article from the 21st century. So you see this, these layers, the people in the year 2900 were looking at a find from the year 2400, which was talking about the 21st century and talking about how people in the 21st century were so stupid because they didn't realize if they just harnessed their consciousness, they could control the weather.
Wait, what?
Yep, I know, right? And he talks about how, like, in the future...
The weather.
Of all things. Quite literal weather.
I really want it to be sunny out right now.
I really wish this is not what it was, but it is. 80 degrees
sounds wonderful.
And I do. Like, part of me has a big respect for Mitchell, but, like, that was totally his bag. That's why this guy succeeded him, is because he was following the same sorts of things that Mitchell was thinking and doing. And I'm proud of anybody and okay with anybody who wants to say, like, oh, I'm going to discover things even if science says it's not going to happen and this and that. But, like, I don't know. It's just hard even for me. Like, and it's me. It's me. I believe in Bigfoot. I don't know. But in any case, the way...
Wait, are you saying believing in Bigfoot is crazy?
I'm saying it's a lot less crazy than believing that you can change the weather just by thinking hard enough. So, or whatever. I didn't read the whole book. I just read the prologue. So, the way, though, that Mitchell ties into all of this, I promise all of that backstory is going to come right back to us here in a moment. The reason he ties into all of this is because he has been speaking out about a UFO cover-up since 1996. Now, he wants to be very clear in stating, like I said, he's never seen an alien. He's never even seen a UFO. However, he's talked to a lot of people.
you don't say, so have I.
A lot of people. And to be fair, as a man who was flying to the moon, he probably had access to people who I will never have access to.
That is also very fair. Late night?
Sure.
Probably.
And he says that these people, you know, like I said, he grew up a few miles from Roswell. He really believed Roswell was a cover-up. He talked to him about it. He asked him about him. They confirmed that, yeah, it's a cover-up and there were alien bodies and they were recovered. And the more people he talked to, the more confirmation he got over and over and over and over again. And this information comes from this interview he gives in 1996. It's on Dateline NBC, primetime programming. And NASA comes out like the next day and says, we have great respect for Dr. Mitchell. He's a great American. We simply do not share his views on the subject that we are covering up all alien existence and life and all of that. So, and of course he fires back and says, well, you are. Now, as far as I can tell, Mitchell never puts names to these claims. They're senior government officials, and that's all we know. However, his claims go far beyond just the existence of ET life and it interacting with us here on the planet. He claims that one of the first places the ETs were ever interested in was White Sands, New Mexico, the location of the White Sands Proving Ground, which is where the nuclear tests took place, which ties it back to our previous episode. And tying it forward to our next episode, there is in fact quite a famous account of UFOs over White Sands, but again, that's for next week. Now, Mitchell also claimed to have, in his uncovering of the cover-up, spoken to other officials. These ones in the Air Force who told him that in addition to frequent and even regular monitoring and disabling of our missiles on bases, and events like that which took place in Big Sur, where the test missile was prematurely grounded by what appeared to be a saucer beaming light into it, these scenarios happen all the time, and they still do with any sort of a test. The idea was you cannot test nuclear capability without the aliens interfering. And this was his message. This was his first message.
Okay.
The ETs came to save us from ourselves. They came to stop us from annihilating ourselves. His second message, in the later part of his life, can be uncovered in a letter, one of many, that was sent shortly before his death, where he claims that the extraterrestrials are still monitoring Earth. and they plan to for the foreseeable future, claiming that they won't permit any sort of military activity or violence, is what he says, military violence, either on Earth or in space. I don't know what he means by that, because obviously there has been a staggering amount of military violence between the Cold War and now, and even during the Cold War with the satellite wars and this and that. So I don't know exactly what that means as far as on Earth, but he made a really big deal about in space. He believes that the next world war will be at least partially fought in space, not by spaceships and people on Mars, but by targeting and attacking other nations' satellites. And
well, that's not a hard leap to go.
No, it's not. Like,
I mean, there's a satellite array that you have to use in order to do a lot of targeting for, say, like shooting carriers in the water, like that kind of stuff, like anti-carrier missiles and things like that. That requires a bunch of different satellites to target stuff. And the U.S. already has essentially anti-satellite missiles.
Well,
like, and we've already got that.
Really, if you think about it, like Katie and I are watching this show called Home Fires, and it's about like life in a little village in World War II, and like the Nazis would fly overhead, and this village wasn't necessarily of a military concern, but it did have like a canal that they used to ship supplies, and so they'd bomb the canal. And it's the same sort of thing where maybe the Verizon wireless satellite isn't a military target, but if you take it out, you're going to affect the lives of people there, as well as the ability for people to communicate with each other. So I think it does make a fair amount of sense. I don't think he's wrong. There are treaties that have been drawn up about this and war in space and this and that and the other thing. But it doesn't stop there. See, Mitchell seems to act or seems to believe that war in space is a concern, but it doesn't need to be the biggest concern because the aliens aren't going to let it happen. They've gone from trying to protect us and stop us from killing ourselves to, at this point, they've essentially offered us a challenge, which is if you can rise to meet this bar of cooperation and nonviolence, you will be infinitely rewarded. You'll be rewarded with something known as zero-point energy. Now, this is something that I've mentioned before. I don't know how it works. I'm not here to talk about it. We will talk about it later, I'm sure, because there's a lot of conspiracy thought and theories around it. But the main idea is something with quantum physics or string theory, but the idea that empty space is not empty space, and that there is a way of extracting energy from somewhere else, whether it's lower or higher dimensions, or even something crazy like an alternate universe sort of thing, punching an energy and pulling it through sort of a thing.
It's probably a very liberal interpretation of like how dark matter works.
Yeah, most likely. And there are real scientists who work on these sorts of things. Doesn't mean they've ever found anything. There's a lot of conspiracy that people have found it and then they've ended up dead, as you'd imagine. I mean, big oil and everything else. But again, I'm not here to talk about zero-point energy itself. I'm here to talk about Edgar Mitchell and his relation to zero-point energy, because in addition to signing his final emails as the sixth man on the moon, he also signed them as ZPE consultant, because he really believed that they were going to crack this. In fact, in one of these emails, one of the people that are speaking for him mentioned how he wants to see, on his 100th birthday, which would have been, I think, 16 years from 2016, so 2032, I think.
Okay.
He was planning to see Earth from the moon taken there by a spaceship powered by zero-point energy. He was very much all about this, and that's a matter of record at this point.
Is he still alive?
No, he is not. He died in 2016.
Oh.
So right before he said that thing about living to be 100, so God bless him.
Don't jinx yourself.
I guess. Story. Make sure you always knock on wood. But here we find a curious connection to the Salute 7 of all those many years ago. Because according to what?
All those many years ago.
Many years ago. According to Mitchell, he and the United States government aren't the only ones who know about and or are possibly working with the extraterrestrials on Zero Point Energy. The other unlikely partner is the smallest country on the face of the Earth, which is Vatican City. Now, the Vatican has often found itself at the center of not just normal conspiracy, but ET conspiracy specifically. The prevailing idea is that the church still boasts the highest membership numbers of any organized church unit. There are 1.2 billion Roman Catholics on the rolls, and therefore they would be vital in assisting especially the religiously minded of the world to accept the fact of an ET existence. And to be fair, a lot of times religion and religious people do expressly speak out against the idea of extraterrestrial life and this and that, so maybe they're the ones who would need some of the most assisting with this new idea. But that's not why Mitchell thinks this. So he thinks that this is happening and that they're working directly with the Vatican, not so that the Vatican can shepherd the faithful into the realization of the extraterrestrial age. No, Mitchell and a group that he appears to become affiliated with which does not seem to have a name. Not in like a creepy way, in just a, oh. I don't think they got around to naming it. So I'm going to refer to it by the names of its leaders, which are Suzanne Mendelsohn and Terry Mansfield. So I'm just going to call it the Mans Mendel Project, because why not? According to the Mans Mendel Project and Edgar Mitchell, the reason that the ETs have been working with the Vatican is because these aliens are, to quote from Mitchell, the highest form of intelligence which works directly with God. That's right. That's right. God and the aliens, they're in it together. Now, this in and of itself is not a unique idea. Like, it sounds a little unique, but Whitley Strieber...
It sounds pretty new agey.
It does sound very new agey.
Whoa.
Whitley Strieber himself talked about how at the highest levels of the beings that he interacted with, the visitors, they were husks to be filled with from a greater power sent out to do the work of that greater power. They were empty, but filled with the spirit of something, basically. So that in and of itself.
I don't like it at all. It just sounds like how we change witches into UFOs. Like, it just sounds like a bastardization of actual UFO culture in order to, like...
Are you defending actual UFOs?
I know what I'm defending.
What is going on?
I don't like when science has gotten to a certain state and then religion has to be like reworked to like define around what currently we know and knowledge. Like, I hate that constant like, oh, well, it has to be this now because of this and this. And that's where we are in the world.
There's like,
it really annoys me.
There's like this idea there's this thing that's talked about in like religious context, which is sometime, which is that for some people, God is not God of everything. He's God of the unknown. So anything that you don't understand, that's God. And then science comes around, figures it out. Well, that can't be God anymore because it's science.
Right.
Whereas spiritual leaders like Pope Francis and the Dalai Lama and people like that say that, well, that's just not how it needs to work. It doesn't need to be that way. But I agree that that can be really quite frustrating.
It's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I agree.
For someone that sits on the side of like science or the side of faith. It's both very frustrating when someone tries to make an amalgamation of both sides into one thing to make it all fit together.
Well, and that's where I think really that's one of the defining characteristics of like the New Age community, yeah, is that they take these ideas of quantum science and these ideas of resonant frequencies.
It's just a fad, bro.
Yeah, I hope so. But in any case,
well, it'll move on to the next fad, whatever it is after that.
Yeah,
it'll just keep evolving.
In any case, on that note, I haven't been able to find what god the aliens are serving. It doesn't appear to be any well-defined theological concept as much as just like a new agey sort of like, ah, there's something direct in the world sort of thing. And it's all good love and energy, which if that's what you believe, I don't care. That's fine. Believe what you believe. I love you no matter what. But the other thing of it, though, is that both Mendelssohn and Edgar Mitchell were both practicing Catholics. So who knows? Maybe it could be. Maybe that is what they're talking about. But according to Mons Mendel, the extraterrestrial intelligence, or ETI, that they and Mitchell have been working with, they come from a contiguous universe, one that is very close to our own, but one in which all beings have become completely obedient to God. And that complete universal obedience brings about complete universal peace and nonviolence, which then allows them to work together to understand the zero-point energy. And once you understand that, I mean, if you think about it, it's essentially limitless energy forever, and you can do anything in the world.
Zero-point energy is essentially their theory of everything. It's like, it's their holy grail.
Yeah, they talk about like this thing.
It's their key that unlocks salvation.
Yeah, they talk about this thing called like the tau neutrino, which is used, and it's not a real thing as far as I know, but like they take that blending of science and science and progress and mix it with faith in God, and it just gets a little strange. But here's what's really interesting about all of this craziness that I've just told you. This information comes from a leak, a WikiLeaks leak, of the emails of former presidential advisor John Podesta, who is the center of many other conspiracy as well, which we are not going to talk about here, thank you very much, and whom has a stated interest in ET life and complete disclosure. Now, I would assume that if somebody who had direct access to the President of the United States started receiving emails that say, I'm working with the aliens to get us limitless energy. All we have to do is to become completely obedient to God, and we will find it. I would assume that those would go primarily into the trash, never to be looked at again. However,
sounds about right to me.
I would hope so. However, Podesta, through his assistants, did at least try to set up a meeting with Mitchell and Mons Mendel.
It's probably like, whoa, more oil? Perfect.
No, they were explicit about the fact that this was zero point energy. And even like talked about like,
sounds like a better way to extract oil.
Because there's like a point where Ed Mitchell goes from not signing his emails ZPE consultant to where he does. And he even mentions it. He says like, postscript, I'm available these days for our Skype meeting, because they decided they wanted to do it over Skype. And then postscript, I am a ZPE consultant now, as you may have seen in my signature. And it's like, okay, it's a weird thing. Also, why are we putting postscripts in emails, people? Come on. It's like, why even have email if we're going to do it that way? Did me dirty.
I'm sorry.
Not you.
You feel so passionate about this.
I'm not.
A little.
Passionate.
What I don't get is why he just went ahead and signed it ZPE instead of like writing out everything, because this is the first time I've ever heard of it. So clearly it's not a household name or sure. Anything like that. Cool.
Cool. I have no answers for you. I'm sorry. So Podesta, or at least his assistants, is like, oh yeah, we're free on these days. And then they say something really astounding, which says, essentially it was, with a meeting like this, we'd most likely start between Dr. Mitchell and Mr. Podesta. But depending on how the meeting goes, we may be able to get Dr. Mitchell, in front of the president. So there is a chance that Edgar Mitchell went to the White House and briefed Barack Obama on the extraterrestrial intelligence that has been not only saving us, but is now trying to allow us to progress if we would only all become subservient and obedient to the higher power.
That's probably how Barack got so gray so quickly.
It's like
meetings like that.
Real time lapse of his hair just dying and withering away. I'm going to say that probably did happen.
Yeah, man. I mean, if you look at a picture of him before the presidency and then like halfway through second term, like, oh man, his hair aged a lot.
It's gone. In any case, those are my cosmonaut astronaut stories. So what are we to think of this?
Oh, wait, that's it?
That's it.
Thank goodness.
I know, it's already been an hour and a half.
Who would have thought? Oh, wait.
You did. Now, right. In regards to the angels, I have one last specific reference. This comes up on almost every article or forum post or anything that I've seen about it. And it is a verse from the New Testament, from the book of Revelations, which, of course, is the book about the end of the world. And it says, quote, "I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues. Last, because with them, God's wrath is completed." That's pretty hardcore. Thank you, John, who wrote Revelation. And it's like, what does this mean? What does any of this mean? Jason, I'm going to assume that you're gonna say that it doesn't mean anything. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. You think that everything can be scientifically explained. What about the angels? What do you think about the angels?
I think there is... So I'm not necessarily like, oh, hogwash, if science can't measure it, then it's not real.
Right.
I'm in the boat of figuring it out.
Right.
Keep asking why and how, and keep digging deeper until you get a solid answer that can be proven by someone else that's also asking those same questions, instead of saying that it is some sort of divine visitation. That's a cop-out.
That's
because
fair.
You don't know how to actually do the science to figure it out.
That's fair.
Figure it out.
Figure it out. That's Jason's words. I don't know what I think about these alien angels.
And as far as the passage you said, it's like, wow, this is old school God that's really mean still.
He's upset.
Angry God.
He's upset.
I would be too.
I would be too. I mean,
look what we're doing to the climate.
I'm upset.
I'm honestly kind of hopeless, really.
That's fair. Just
I'm
give
sad.
Up. Submit to the soil of the earth.
Or learn law and become governor.
What?
And then president.
Whoa. I like this. I like this new Jason.
Let's make a difference.
All right. I like that. Yeah, who knows? We won't know. We won't know for a very long time, if ever, what actually happened in space that day, what these people are actually seeing, and why on God's green earth Edgar Mitchell believes that he is speaking, or believed that he was somehow in communication with aliens from a contiguous universe that were trying to give us zero-point energy if only we would become obedient to higher law. I don't know. But it makes for a good story. And that's really all we have here is good stories.
And that's why we are not a history podcast.
We are not a history podcast. Next week...
We dash with history. But the main ingredients are not history.
No. Next week, we are going to be looking at another final step of this, which is not, and in the first episode I said the hippie movement. It's not necessarily hippies that we're talking about, but rather cases of people interacting with extraterrestrials face to face during this time period and being told messages of reassurance and love and peace and hope, which is not really something that happens that much anymore when people are ostensibly interacting with ETs. And we're going to talk about the phenomena of the Space Brothers, which is something that also came out of this Cold War terror. So we'll get back to you with that,
is that
next
just
week.
The Doobie Brothers? I'm confused.
Doobie Brothers, time and space. In any case, we do have... Unless, Jason, do you have anything?
I got nothing, bro.
Okay, I didn't think so. I really liked that speech you gave at the end. That was pretty good.
What, about science and
about
the pursuit of
figure
knowledge?
Figure it out. Yeah, I like that.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Do it.
Whoa.
Sorry.
Science, just do it. Right? That's how that works.
No, that's Nike.
Oh.
A little different.
Oh, that's fair. We'd like to go ahead and thank. We got one new patron this week. So we would like to go ahead and thank Vera Fernandez. Woohoo!
Vera.
Thank you so much for your donation. It truly keeps the lights on. Right now in this room, we have two lights, but who knows?
There might be more in there the kitchen where we're usually at.
Where we usually record. So we really appreciate those
donations.
This
is the max amount of light that we can have on
it is.
In this room.
It is, so. Unless we buy another lamp, which...
We might be able to do now.
Because of your donations.
Thanks,
so
folks.
Thank you. We'd also like to thank Crutch601. They say, informative and entertaining. I really enjoy these guys. They dig into a wide variety of topics. They have a great rapport, and each episode leaves me ready for the next. So thank you so much to everybody who writes us our iTunes reviews. We really appreciate them. And yeah, we really just appreciate anything you've got. Whether you want to look at becoming a patron, getting access to early postings of episodes, unedited content, stuff like that, or our bonus episodes. If you want to leave an iTunes review, we appreciate that. If you want to join our Facebook group or like us on Facebook, the group is called Remember We Are Not Alone, a Community for the Strange. You can like us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. If you just want to tell a friend about the show, that's awesome as well. Or really, truly, if you just want to keep listening week after week, that's the best thing you can do for us anyway. So we appreciate all of you. We're so grateful to have you as our listeners, and especially during this Thanksgiving season, I'm thankful for you. And Jason, I'm thankful for you.
Really?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell.
Dude! I can't believe this.
Oh, man. I'm going to keep this going until this. Like a year. All
until
year.
Next Friendsgiving?
Yes.
And then you're going to bring it up at Friendsgiving?
Of course.
All right. Anyway.
You know, last year, Sam didn't even tell me about this.
I thank all of you for all you are and all you will ever be. Wassalamu alaikum. I really don't know what else to say.
Yeah, stop going off on a tangent. Yeah. If you're in the U.S., happy Thanksgiving. I hope you enjoy your time. We enjoy the time that you get to spend with us.
There we go. If you're not in the U.S., what are you
happy
doing?
Happy Thursday.
Come on, happy Thursday. other than that, you can find us on Twitter. I'm Beer Lord Elfbane on Twitter, and Jason is...
What?
Huh?
You were really slow at saying at, which threw me off. At Mighty Moit.
At Mighty Moit. And I already talked about Facebook, and we don't check the Instagram, and you can...
I might check Twitter this week. I don't know.
Oh, there we go. And we're at Not Alone Pod on Twitter as well. You can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com or send your stories for us to read and potentially use in our next listener special. You can send those to notalonepodstories@gmail.com. Guys, have a wonderful week. You did it last week.
I did.
Okay.
It was bad.
That's okay.
Do better.
This is probably gonna be bad too. Remember, whether you find yourself alone in the vacuum of space, only to find something out there with you, watching you, thinking about you, loving you.
Wait, what?
Or you find yourself all alone in your bedroom at night. No one there. No one to love you. No one to think about you. No one to look at you. Completely, completely alone. You are not alone.